Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Do you know that some parents right now are demanding prescriptions for Ritalin and Adderall for their teenage children? And it's not because of any supposed disease or syndrome. It's because they want them to have higher academic performance. You know, this society really has bought into the idea that there's a pill for everything. And we have now so deluded ourselves in this pharmacological society that we really believe that what answers any problem is a pill. And every child, like in the proverbial Lake Wobegon, has to be above average. And so if someone's teenager isn't performing academically as is expected, then go get them a pill. Doctors are reporting that parents are showing up demanding Ritalin because Ritalin as a stimulant, along with its friend pill Adderall, are often used in order to focus. On college campuses today, academic doping is a big issue. And the black market sales of Ritalin and Adderall are never far from view because students know if they take them while they're studying or they take them while they're taking a test that there are some benefits in terms of concentration and memory recall and all the rest. And so now this is filtering down to the high school. How long will it be before middle schoolers are taking their test pill? And then they go home to take their homework pill. And then at night they take their study pill. We are reaching the point where this is becoming insane. We have become an enhancement society, and we are turning our children into drugged students. Academic doping is the issue today on the Albert Mohler Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the time for Christians to be involved in an intelligent conversation about just what we expect of our children. And what kind of performance do we demand of them? And if it doesn't turn out as we want, do we just put them on a pill? The number 877-893-8255. If the doctors are concerned, we had better be concerned. First, a review of some issues in the news at my website, albertmohler.com. I deal with the new book by Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is the Charles Simonyi Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. He is one of the most atheistic, secularistic minds in the world today, and in his latest book entitled The God Delusion, he issues a 400-page frontal assault upon belief in God. Now, we're going to take this as a show topic. We're going to devote an entire program to talking about this book in coming days. But I want you to know that what we have here is an interesting correlation. We have several things happening at once. As a matter of fact, we have three interesting books released almost simultaneously. Sam Harris's book, Letter to a Christian Nation, Daniel Dennett's book also suggesting that belief in God is a delusion, and now The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. You have three of the most publicized atheists or secularists in the world who have released these three books simultaneously. Now, let me just get to the very end of my essay. You'll find it. It's a large review essay on this book that's available at my website, albertmohler.com. That's M-O-H-L-E-R. And at the very end, I make this point, and it is to this point we'll return when we take this up again. I make this point. Why does Dawkins acknowledge that that Christianity amounts to a treasured heritage? What he says is we need to retain some of these habits, some of these traditions, without the belief in God. I said it must be because in the end, even Richard Dawkins is not as much of an atheist as he believes himself to be. If Dawkins is so certain that theism is dead, why would he spend so much of his time and energy opposing it? A man who is genuinely certain that Christianity is passing away would feel no need to write a 400-page book in order to urge its passing. Something's going on here, and in one sense, we should take the emergence of these three books as something of a tribute to the lasting power of Christianity and to the fact that against all of the prophecies of the positivists and the sociologists and the secularists, it has not passed away. Belief in God has not passed away. And as a matter of fact, what perplexes these people more than anything else, when you really read their books and listen to them talk, is the number of Americans in particular who say that their Christian faith informs their decisions about everyday life. It would not be a threat if this Christianity held by so many Americans was simply a closeted faith that had nothing to do with everyday life. But when it does have to do with everything about everyday life, it does have to do with what's taught in the schools, it does have to do with what comes out of the courts, it does have to do with what defines a family, it does have to do with the freedom to declare the gospel, then there is a very different response, and that's what we see in these books. More on that later. But just brace yourselves. You're going to be seeing Richard Dawkins once again all over the talk shows and all over the newspapers and the news magazines, because a book like this is going to get a lot of attention. We live in a therapeutic age. And oh, how we are reminded of this every time we turn on the television and listen to one of the soothing shows in which people talk about their problems. Or when you go into the bookstore and you are surrounded by all of these therapeutic titles competing for attention. They all want to tell us that our problem is something that can be cured by therapy. Richard Friedman, a psychiatrist writing in the New York Times today, suggests that empathy and understanding just aren't enough. And this is very interesting. He's not writing from any explicitly Christian worldview. He's simply saying, look, the current regime of therapy has hit a brick wall. It isn't working. Why isn't it working? It's because what therapists want to be is liked. They want to be liked by their clients. They want to be liked by their patients. And so they demonstrate understanding and empathy. Richard Friedman, psychiatrist writing in the New York Times, is talking about a patient that came to see him. He said, what do you hope to accomplish in therapy? Quote, I just want to feel better and get rid of this depression. Tell me, how do you feel about your therapist? Oh, she's terrific, warm, understanding, and always available, but I don't feel like I'm any better. In other words, just empathizing isn't enough. Dr. Friedman goes on to say, we seem to live in a blame-addicted culture that is perfectly reflected in everything from reality TV to bad psychology, psychotherapy. Since nearly everyone has had some adversity or disappointment in life, there is an endless supply of excuses for present unhappiness or just plain bad behavior. It's easier to whine about the past than to take some responsibility to change one's life. Very, very interesting. Now, that's not coming from a preacher. That's not even coming someone who's speaking from an explicitly Christian perspective. Not at all. It's coming from a psychiatrist just saying, look, this therapy regime doesn't work. You can affirm people all you want, but if you're affirming them and encouraging them in bad behavior or in irresponsible psychological states, you're simply confirming them in their problem. And they will like you, but they're not going to have any success in solving the problems that brought them to the therapist in the first place. You know, this is another reminder to me of why we have to push back against this therapeutic culture. Why, at the basic level of worldview, we have to come back and say, look, the basic problem isn't something outside of ourselves that happened to us. The basic problem is something that is inside of us. The problems we face are the result of something inside of us that is sick working its way out, not something outside of us that's working its way in. That's why therapy starts and ends generally in the wrong place. We don't need to be encouraged so much as we need to be informed of the truth. And we need to be pointed to the only rescue from this predicament. And that's why the only true therapy that works isn't therapy at all. It's the Christian gospel that promises not that we can feel better about ourselves, but that the old has passed away. Behold, all things have become new. We do not deny that there are persons who would suffer with very real psychological problems. I certainly would not deny that there are people out there that are suffering from deep depression and from many other problems. I wouldn't deny that there's even a physical link between many of these psychological states and the problems people experience. I will say that in the end, the only real answer is to be at peace with the Creator. And the only real problem, that the central problem that must be addressed, isn't a problem that psychotherapy can touch. It's the problem of human sin. All kinds of reports, especially over the last couple of years, about the differences between men and women in science. John Tierney, columnist for the New York Times, again, writing today, and this is remarkable considering he's on the editorial board of the New York Times, shows up as an op-ed piece in the New York Times. John Tierney says, the problem with a lot of these reports about bias and discrimination against women in the sciences is that they just aren't honest. As he says, feminist politics are trumping the data. Yes, more men are going into the hard sciences than women. But as he says here, when a woman is up for tenure today in science or engineering, her odds of being approved are the same as a man's. A committee headed by former Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shirley, also, by the way, former president of the University of Wisconsin, is out suggesting that it's pervasive bias against women that leads to this. Here's one of the findings, according to John Tierney, of this report. The academic success of girls now equals or exceeds that of boys at the high school and college levels, rendering moot all discussions of the biological and social factors that once produced sex differences in achievement at those levels. End quote. Well, Mr. Tierney comes back and says, look, that's beside the point. We're not asking whether girls are good enough at science. He suggests the bigger issue is that adolescent boys have a real interest in science where most adolescent girls do not. He says this, as adolescents, the boys are especially interested in abstract theoretical pursuits and inorganic disciplines involving things, whereas the girls are more interested in social values, people contact, and organic disciplines. He goes on to say plenty of those girls end up going to graduate school, and some become superb physicists and engineers, but many choose law, medicine, education, and the soft sciences like biology or psychology. In other words, he says, look, boys are more interested in these fields, the hard sciences, dealing with things. It's not that women aren't up to this. It's that just maybe boys and girls are different. Men and women have different interests. And it's not discrimination that explains why a woman might go into another field following other interests. We'll be back to talk about academic doping. And I'm Albert Moeller. Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. One of the things we try to do on this program is look at the deeper issues. What underlies the kinds of things you read about in the headlines? And every once in a while, well, regularly, as a matter of fact, stories cross my desk that just catch my attention because I say, look, there is a great illustration of the bigger problem. Here's the illustration from today. I wrote about it at my website, albertmoeller.com. That's M-O-H-L-E-R.com. An article entitled Salvation in a Pill, Academic Doping, and America's Parents. MSNBC's out with a pretty important report here. I think very important. Having to do with the fact that a large number of American parents are now taking their kids to doctors, demanding prescriptions for Ritalin and Adderall and other psychotropic drugs, not because of any particular problem that the child has, other than they want the child to do better in school. Now, some time back, on America's college and university campuses, students who were previously diagnosed with ADHD or other similar syndromes were showing up with Ritalin, and they discovered that, hey, I can study with greater concentration if I take this pill. And if I take this pill before I go in to take my chemistry exam, I'm going to perform better because Ritalin is a stimulant. And as a psychotropic stimulant, it stimulates the brain to greater concentration. And let's face it, you know, if you can concentrate to a greater degree, you just might do better both studying and performing on an exam. But what's normal? I mean, this is the issue, isn't it? Ronald Cole Turner, a bioethicist, suggests that we now are enhancement enthusiasts. As a culture, we've simply bought into the idea that if we can enhance performance, we should. It's almost like there's now a moral mandate. Go out and enhance performance. So we have athletes taking steroids all over the place. And now we have students on college and university campuses buying black market Ritalin and Adderall before they take their math exam. Or before they do the all-nighter to cram for an exam the next day. These pills, I'm told, are selling now on an average between $15 and $25. And that means that some kid who has a prescription for a supposed problem with Ritalin is now selling his pills to his peers who just want to enhance academic performance. The MSNBC piece was really interesting because it cites doctors who are exasperated. Dr. James Perrin, a Boston pediatrician, told of a 15-year-old girl who came in with her parents. The family was convinced that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, was at fault with the girl's slipping grades and that a prescription for Ritalin would boost her brain power. The doctor, however, determined that she didn't have ADHD. By the way, I find that almost unusual because almost everyone I know is told they have it. But nonetheless, the parents who had come in demanding a prescription left empty-handed. This doctor, who's a professor of pediatrics at the Harvard Medical School, said this is increasingly common, facing parents who say, I want my kid to make better grades, give her Ritalin or Adderall or a similar drug. Now, on my website, in my article, I make this argument. We have bought into this kind of idea of enhancement, but worse than that, I think we've learned a really bad lesson from the last century. I think over the 20th century, we learned a lesson that is perverse and it is very dangerous, and it's this, that salvation is found in a pill. And so, you know, I ask these questions and give these answers on my website. I suggest the 20th century taught many lessons. One of the most perverse of these lessons is that salvation is found in a pill. Got an infection? Take an antibiotic. Can't sleep? Take a sedative. Can't breathe? Take an antihistamine. Can't cope? Take a psychotropic pill. Can't perform sexually? Take Viagra. Can't keep up with other athletes? Take a steroid. Can't remember which pill you're to take for which problem? Take a memory enhancer. And now, if you want to get better grades, or you want your kid to get better grades, take Ritalin, or Adderall, or another psychotropic drug. Folks, as Christian parents, we had better ask some hard questions. What do we expect of our children? Do we expect that they will do their best? Do we expect that they will learn incrementally? Do we expect that our children are all going to be above average? I mean, let's just point out, that's mathematically impossible. It's not possible that every kid is going to deserve a Rhodes Scholarship. It's simply not possible that every kid's going to gain academic admission to an Ivy League university. It's just not possible that everyone gets A's. We are living in an age, if you're on a Little League team, everyone has to get a trophy. All must have prizes. Melanie Phillips, who was on this program some time ago, made that point in a book she published in Great Britain. All must have prizes. Everyone has to get a trophy. But in any sane academic system, not everyone's going to get an A. And it's not about therapy. It's about whether you actually perform. And I can tell you that as an educator, I'm confronted from time to time with people who think the grades are about self-assurance and encouragement rather than performance and achievement. I think we as Christian parents have to understand that it is a cheap way out and a dangerous way out to teach our children that the way they improve themselves is by taking a pill. But I want to know what you think about this. Are we chemically doping our children in order that they may perform in a better way academically? That's a tough question. I think it's tough only in the sense there are a lot of parents who would do this. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Detroit, Michigan, where Ron's listening on XM170. Go ahead, Ron.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. A couple comments. One, I guess to start off with the question, do we have any information about some of the really academic-driven cultures like Asia, Korea, China, Japan? Do they have this similar sort of issue? And then I have a couple comments as well.
Yeah. Oh, hang on with me, Ron. I will tell you that in this particular report from MSNBC, I don't see anything like that. But as we pulled up other data and we've been building an extensive file on this, it is clear that in Western Europe and in some Asian countries, Japan in particular, that academic doping is kind of the least of the problems having to do with academic pressures. As a matter of fact, in Japan, academic competition among adolescents is so fierce that the suicide rate for Japanese adolescents is much higher than for American adolescents having to do with academic issues, because if you don't get in university, the entire family's honor is at stake. In terms of the use of Ritalin and other things, I think you can pretty much count that across Western industrialized societies and modern industrialized societies such as Japan, you're going to find a lot of this. And as a matter of fact, the sales of Ritalin in these countries are going up and up and up. In Great Britain, a 700% increase over the last 4 years, a multiple increase many times over, also in a lot of the Pacific Rim nations. And, you know, part of the problem is with something like this ADHD, if you look at the description, almost everyone has it, or at least goes through it, or has moments like it. Does that make any sense, Ron?
No, it does. And, you know, I have three children myself, and my wife and I have long been concerned about our trend towards using medications, depression medication being one of the leaders, where everybody, if you have a sad thought more than a couple days in a row, you need to be on medication.
Yeah.
We have many friends that are, and it really disappoints us to see our Christian friends rely so heavily on that, where, you know, the only true source of joy is in the Lord. And the trend concerns me with this as well, and I haven't heard about it until you mentioned it today, and I'm glad you brought it to my attention, because I'm concerned about my children who strive to be good academically, and you know, I'm worried about the pressures they're going to now face with their friends on their SAT days, you know, going and taking Ritalin, and, you know, how are they going to feel? Are they going
That's
to have
right.
a unfair advantage because they don't have Ritalin, you know, same way with kids taking steroids so they can be better with the sports scene.
Yeah, you know, Ron, there's another aspect to this I want to ask you. You say you have three children, boys or girls?
Two boys and a girl. Oldest is 9.
Okay, one of the phenomenal aspects of this, in my mind, is that we're basically mostly talking about boys when it comes to those who were medicalized with the psychotropic drugs. The vast majority, 3.5 times as many boys as girls. And a part of it is because boys just aren't naturally made for the academic culture in so many ways. Not the way we have constructed the academic culture. And so, you know, a lot of what's going on here is trying to chemically turn boys into girls. I mean, just in terms of behavior, expectation. You start looking at the stuff that describes ADHD, and it's pretty much your pre-adolescent and adolescent male right there. So I think that's another aspect of this that's troubling. Ron, thanks for your call. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're talking about academic doping, and we'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back, folks. We're talking about academic doping, and that's something that needs to be underlined. We're really not talking about, on this program today, we're not talking about the kinds of prescriptions that are given for these drugs for other kinds of problems. That will be a different conversation. And I have to come back again to say I'm not a doctor, I'm not a physician, and I don't play one on the radio. So I'm not prescribing drugs, nor am I non-prescribing them. I'm simply talking about the theological, spiritual, and cultural ramifications of a culture in which parents are now asking for these drugs for their kids simply so they'll do better academically. As if, by the way, getting a B is a disease. I think a whole host of questions are raised by this. Let me just suggest to you some of them. How do we define success and achievement? Is achievement always getting A's, or is it doing the best you can and doing better this time than you did last time because you learned something? You know, that's a very different standard of achievement. But the false standard of achievement that's held out there is simply quantitative. It has to do with how you get into college and, you know, what rank you have in your class, et cetera, et cetera. Just what are our expectations for our kids? Do they all have to be above normal? Well, I mean, all of us secretly want that. Let's just be honest. But the problem is they can't all be smarter than normal because that's what normal is. If everyone was smarter than normal, the new normal would be smarter. Other questions, are we really ready to put our children on powerful stimulants just to raise their grades and test scores? And what are we teaching our kids when we do this? You know, one of the interesting things about this is that you really don't get ahead this way, not long term, because it works like this. You have a kid that's getting C's, and mom or dad says, you know, if we gave him Ritalin, maybe he'd get B's. And the kid who's getting B's, his mom or dad says, well, maybe if we gave him Ritalin, he'd get A's. Well, what about the kid who's getting A's? You know, her dad says, well, let's find out what she can do. Let's put her on Ritalin, and maybe she'll not only get A's, maybe she'll cure cancer in the 11th grade. And so what you have is everyone gets ramped up. And so the kid that will be getting, what, 1,100 on the SAT might get a little bit higher, but the kid who is going to get 1,300 is getting higher, and the kid who's going to get 1,550, he's going to get a little higher too. And so you're not really getting ahead. What you're doing is redefining our expectations for our children. Indeed, we're redefining what we think normal human achievement looks like. We want to push our children. We want to encourage our children. We want to hold high standards for our children. But the question is this, are we ready to put them on pills? Just so that they can do better academically. And by the way, these pills have side effects. And again, I'm not a pharmacologist, I'm not a physician, but you can just look it up or talk to parents whose kids have been on these drugs. And furthermore, you know, if you're going to give them a pill to do better on the SAT, then why not let them take the steroid so that they can build a little more muscle mass for the football team? You know, morally, what's the difference? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. This is a fascinating question to me. It's a fascinating question, and when I consider this as a theologian, as a minister, as an observer of the culture, but also as a parent, this is kind of close to home. Two teenage children, well, why not get them these pills? Maybe they'd be doing a whole lot better. I mean, they're doing great, but, you know, maybe they could do greater. Maybe we could turn them into little intellectuals who will absolutely blow the tops off of every chart and set new standards, cure cancer in the 11th grade. You know, that's just one of the things you start looking at and you say, you know, where does childhood go in the midst of this? Where does the experience of having to come home when you got a B when you should have gotten an A? And maybe you need a little parental encouragement to study a little harder. Maybe it's not go take the pill. Maybe it's go hit the book. You know, I think we're teaching a lot of bad lessons here. And then what do you do with the rest of your life on this? Well, you know, once you get out of high school, well, you're going to continue the academic doping in college. Don't tell me that it's going to stop when you graduate from high school. If you get in the college you want to get into, then in order to stay up in terms of the class, well, you're going to have to take the pill again. And then once you graduate, what next? Well, if you go to graduate school, you just continue the academic doping. But what if you go out into the business world? Well, I mean, how are you going to concentrate? You know, and then how many pills do you take? Is salvation in a pill? I think that's one of the most dangerous lessons of the 20th century. It's one of those lessons that greatly, greatly concerns me. And let's be very honest. We're thankful for a lot of those pills. I'm thankful for penicillin. I'm thankful for the antibiotics that have saved so many millions of lives. I'm thankful for analgesics that save people from pain. I'm thankful for all kinds of drugs. But folks, something has gone horribly wrong here. When parents show up at a pediatrician's office saying, look, here's the drug I want for my kid because I'm tired of these B's in biology. I want to see some A material out of this kid. Give him a pill, and if you don't give it to me, I'll find a doctor who will. Who needs the help here, the kid or the parent? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Mohler Program. Feeling you want to talk about this. Again, to read the articles, first go to my piece at albertmohler.com. That's Albert, M-O-H-L-E-R.com. And then you can follow the links and see the other materials. This ought to be discussed by parents. I'd love to see what some moms and dads would say reading this article. But let's listen to what some will say on the air. Let's go to Laurie calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA radio. Go ahead, Laurie.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I think it depends on the child. My son happens to be have it easy in school. It comes easily to him. But if it didn't, I would sure want to have, you know, that option of being able to get him the medication so that he could be on a level playing field with everyone else. And also something that you had said earlier about, you know, telling the children, well, something to the effect that, you know, it's, you're doing your best, or, you know, if they're exceptional in school, well, then you say, well, you know, I think that you can excel further, you know.
Right.
So I think it just depends on the child, really.
Well, let me ask you, though, Lori, I want to understand what you're saying here. When you say level the playing field, I mean, does that mean that chemically we should make all kids at the same level of performance?
No, I think that if it's an option, if it's something available, then I think we, you know, and it's not going to harm the child, then I think that we should definitely make use of it. You know, especially
really?
If it's going to make them have an easier time in school, then, you know, they don't have to struggle so much, you know.
Well, that's an interesting point. I appreciate you calling. I will say I think it's going to make it more difficult for them in life. Learning the lesson that you take a pill and you won't have to work so hard, because I don't think that's going to apply to other issues of life. And I think it's also going to completely mess up the academic system where, you know, for instance, right now, there are serious legal questions about the fairness of standardized tests when some kids are chemically assisted and others are not. You know, in other words, not only do you have the C student who might make a B, but you also have the A student who says, look, I can knock the very top off this thing if I just have a pill. Appreciate your call, Laurie. Something to think about there. Let's go to Denise calling from Largo, Florida, listening on WTBN. Go ahead, Denise.
Hi. My son was on medication for attention deficit disorder for three and a half years, 2 years in elementary and a year and a half in middle school. And he took it because he could not concentrate, he could not pay attention, and in fourth and fifth grade, he went from straight Fs in third grade to As and Bs in fourth and fifth. But you give this pill to a normal kid, and he doesn't make better grades. It actually works as a stimulant. But I took my son off because in middle school, which is primarily geared to girls, he was having to go to lockers and keep track of books, and it doesn't do anything for the disorganizational part of attention deficit.
Now, Denise, are you telling me that boys that age are disorganized?
Yeah. Boys this age are, for the most part, I can't say across the board, more disorganized than girls. I have a friend who has a girl that has this problem, too. So it's not just girls and boys, but is primarily. And now that he's in a private school that's geared to kids who have learning disabilities, who teach them according to their needs, he's doing fine. So I think the public school system is a lot of the problem, that their expectations for every kid to be the same is a lot of the problem.
Well, you've thrown a lot on the table here, Denise. I was teasing you when I asked about the boys being disorganized, because I tell you, I think you can pretty much generalize that. Again, I think when you start looking at how these particular syndromes and patterns are described, they pretty much describe Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. I mean, that's what you're looking at here. You're not so much looking at the girls that age. They're coming home, looking better than when they left, with their purse all neatly organized. They know what's in their locker. They know the combination, and they actually, remember to lock it and come home. Whereas, I can just tell you that you're lucky if your middle school son comes home with the books and actually remembers what he's supposed to do. And if he comes home with his shoes on some days, you need to be thankful for that. And no pill. Denise is right. No pill is going to solve that problem. Thanks for your call, Denise. Let's go to Mary calling from Corydon, Indiana, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, Dr. Waller. Thanks for taking my call. I had a son that was diagnosed with ADD years ago. He's now out of college and works for Exxon. He no longer takes the drug. He took himself off of it because of the side effects. I don't think parents realize what they're trying to do to their children by putting them on a drug that, like you said, and it does, creates many side effects. Nervousness, there's palpitation of the heart, and just a variety of things can happen. I don't think any drug is the answer to have our children be smarter or more intelligent. And like you said before, I wonder about what our expectations are of our children and what kind of an example are we setting to go to a doctor. I mean, I dread going to the doctor. I dread when the doctor says, you need this pill for this or that. I've got a heart problem, and it's due to drugs and alcohol that I did when I was growing up and going through college. And, I did the speed thing when I was going to college just to try to get myself more alert.
Well, Mary, that's a fascinating point, because that is an analogy here. I think a lot of the kids that were taking amphetamines back in the 1960s, if they could have had Ritalin, they would have had the same kind of stimulation, because it too is a chemical stimulant. But now all of a sudden we're prescribing this and even demanding the prescriptions, whereas, the kids were arrested for taking amphetamines in years past. Thanks for your call, Mary. Let's go to Jill calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Jill.
Hi. When I think about parents putting their children on medication, and taking this drug, and my son is diagnosed ADHD, and one thing that was explained to me when he went on this medication is that when a child is diagnosed with ADHD, this is a stimulant drug, but it has a direct opposite effect with children with ADHD. So, if you're giving this drug to a child who is not diagnosed, which is a physical condition, with ADHD, you're giving your child a stimulant. And so, why a parent would want to give their child a drug that it's not even indicated for, it's beyond me to understand.
Jill, thanks for your call. That's what we're being told is happening here. This professor of pediatrics at the Harvard Medical School says parents are showing up demanding Ritalin because they think it will improve their kids' grades. Let's face it, we're in a performance society. When parents meet each other, what do you want to do? You want to brag about their kids? What happens when you send out the Christmas letter? I mean, don't you kind of dread those? Who sends out a Christmas letter saying, the kids are, just like last year, pretty average? We're proud of them, our average kids. No, we're in a performance society, and we want our kids to perform. When I come back, I'm going to talk about how that warps parenting. I'll be right back. Leslie's calling from the Navajo Reservation up in the Four Corners in New Mexico. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Hello. I am a special education teacher on the Navajo Reservation, and something that we try and have the parents do. Now, my teachers definitely want kids on medication. Most teachers do. Right now, we're in a performance-based society. But we try and talk to the parents about maybe we need to look at their diet first. We have a lot of kids that are on carbs and a lot of sugars. And we've done this in the past where they've changed the diet, and the children tend to do better and can remain in the classroom versus going on the medication right away.
You know, you raise a very interesting point, Leslie, because one of the things I think about when I read an article like this is, look, I mean, we all are concerned with performance. I mean, the kid's going to perform better if he's had a night's sleep. I mean, so the kid that's had sleep is going to have an enhancement over the one that hasn't had sleep. But that's natural. I mean, that's not asking for a psychotropic drug. The kid's going to do better if he's had something to eat and has, you know, proper nutrition and all the rest. He's going to do better if he's well rather than sick. And so, you know, there are all kinds of things like that that are just common sense, but that doesn't require a psychotropic drug. I think it's when you go out for a psychotropic drug simply to increase, you know, academic ability or to help the kid to make some kind of academic jump, there's a real problem. Leslie, I appreciate hearing from you as a special education teacher. You've got a front row seat. And by the way, you know, a lot of this has to do with boys. Leslie, isn't that right? Aren't most of the parents coming to you or most of the people coming to you about students who are boys rather than girls?
Majority of them are.
Yeah.
Majority. But there still are some girls out there. But once they hit a certain age, the drugs have the reverse effect. And it's extremely, I mean, the pharmacists take a lot of precaution about dealing these drugs out. They double-check the physician's prescriptions because right now it's one of the hottest things out there on the black market trying to get. The kids want them to get high on.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole nother show. Appreciate you mentioning that, though, Leslie. The misuse of these drugs is rampant. By the way, this adds whole new levels of complexity. For instance, if you're a school, because given the current law and all the rest, you can't let kids be popping the pills in the classroom. So instead, you have to have a school nurse to dispense all of this. And so you have to have a line outside her office with all the kids showing up for their pill or shot or whatever at the certain time. That's a far cry from where it was when I was in school, I'll just have to admit. You know, the passing of generations has really changed what we expect of schools, what we expect of our kids, and all the rest. A lot of folks wanted to call in today, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to all your calls. Let's remember, this show was about the use of these drugs for academic purposes, not for described diseases. That will be another show. Folks, we'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll talk about whatever's on your mind, and I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.